Joshua Toomey here of the Talk To Me podcast. And before we get into this next episode on the CMS Podcast Network, let's talk about the Talk To Me t-shirt. It is awesome. It has a skull, pizza, and headphones, all the great things in life. So if you want to support the Talk To Me podcast, head over to talktomepod.com, scroll to the bottom of the screen, order yourself a Talk To Me t-shirt. Let your friends and family know that you support the Talk To Me podcast, and that will be much appreciated. So once again, guys, talktomepod.com. And now on to the episode you actually came to see.
All right, well, here we go. Welcome to another episode of Aftershocks. At AftershocksTV.com on the CMS Podcast Network. And on this episode, we're talking 80s hard rock and specifically about this brand new book from our guest today titled Nothing But a Good Time, The Uncensored History of the 80s Hard Rock Explosion. Comes out March 16th. We've got author-producer Tom Bourgeois and author-journalist Richard Beanstock joining us today on Aftershocks. Guys, thanks so much for coming on. How you guys doing?
Great.
Thanks for having us.
Oh, man. No, my pleasure, man. I'll tell you, this book, Nothing But a Good Time, I've read a lot of books, over the years that hone in on this era of music. And I've, all types of autobiographies like, Guns N' Roses books and Motley Crue ones. I've watched numerous documentaries. So to me, I thought there was like not going to be too much that I didn't already know from sort of the scope I had already with, from this knowledge I had from this era. But man, I'll tell you, I was wrong, man. This book has got to be really the most comprehensive source that I've read in terms of, the music coming out in the 80s. I mean, it's such a deep dive into that scene, especially the LA scene with the hard rock and glam metal stuff that was happening then. And yeah, anybody who loves minutiae of rock music in general, man, is going to love this book. So before we sink our teeth into the book itself, into some of the, stories and topics you guys have in there. Let's first just give our listeners, a bit of a, background into your guys' career, within the music industry. I know you both really have impressive resumes. So Tom, we'll start with you. Just tell, the listeners a little bit about yourself.
So I am, like Rich, a musician who also ended up then being a music journalist. I was at Guitar World from 94 till about 99. And then I co-founded Revolver Magazine, did a sort of guitar, luxury guitar magazine called Guitar Aficionado Magazine. And sort of that whole time also was recording bands and then switched to doing that more full time. So I've produced, a lot of alternative rock stuff like Juliana Hatfield and Not a Surf and bands like that. And I still, do that a lot and still do freelance writing as well. So that's sort of the last 30 years in 30 seconds or less.
Oh, nice. Awesome. All right, Rich.
Well, like Tom said, we spent many years, more than a decade at Guitar World together, editing and writing. Like Tom, I am also a musician. I play guitar, played in a lot of bands over the course of my career, have played in bands where we've opened for bands like Twisted Sister and for Bret Michaels. I've played with Poison. I've played with LA Guns, doing different stuff with them, not as part of the band, but just as a guest. Along with Guitar World, also worked the luxury magazine Tom's talking about, Guitar Aficionado. I worked there for the last however many years. I've been purely a freelance writer, writing for Rolling Stone, the New York Times, Billboard, places like that, doing some books as well. Kurt Cobain book for the documentary that came out a few years ago, Montage of Heck. I did that book. I've done a Slash book. I just did a book with Mark Weiss, The Decade That Rocked. Which was all 80s photos. And and then here we are doing this book.
Yeah. Like I said, impressive careers you both have. Fantastic, man. Well, the first thing, talking about the book that stood out to me before I even started reading it was really the expansive list of musicians and industry professionals who were, in the book that you had quoted in there. I mean, it's quite the impressive list, to say the least. So, I mean, were the interviews you guys did and the quotes, were they just a combination of ones you did, obviously, for the book, as well as ones that you had done, say, previously when you guys were journalists?
I'd say it's about 85-15, like at least 85% of it, maybe 90% of it was new for the book. Like, we did a lot of interviews for this book, like you know, almost 200. There were some people, you know, like that we had spoken to over the years where we even used old interviews and new ones. So it was very useful to have 20-25 years of stuff to fall back on for people who we couldn't get to. But mostly it was people that we spoke to specifically for the book. And then, you know, there was even a couple like where we actually used, you know, other people's stuff just because we hadn't spoken to them, we couldn't get to them. But we made a real effort and went down swinging, you know, whenever possible to get a new interview for the book, because we knew exactly what we wanted, you know, and we needed specific stories to have them talk about. But it was a lot for the book, you know, like four years of doing it. Some people it took like a year and a half to get to do an interview. A lot of legwork.
Very cool. Yeah, I mean it's really, like I said, the list is unbelievable what you guys have done in here. You know, the first thing I want to talk about, you know, in terms of what's in the book. I mean, I could talk about this book all day long, I really can, but the first thing I really want to hone in on is, you know, as we all know, you know, Van Halen, they were obviously the stalwarts there in L.A. that would sort of pave the way for the L.A. metal scene, you know, in the 80s. They came around, obviously, late 70s and obviously in the early 80s. But you guys do a great job of laying out that, you know, talking specifically about how there was that gap between Van Halen breaking out and then the whole new wave and punk thing that was going on in L.A. at the time. So there was a pretty significant gap. There's hardly any, basically no LA, you know, hard rock and metal bands were getting signed, you know, after Van Halen broke out because of all the power pop and new wave that was going on. Obviously the Knack, My Sharona was huge, and they had all the bands, as they say, the Motels, I mean, you know, all those bands. But this is really the first, you know, publication I've read where you guys really give the proper, I think, attention and notoriety to really the band that knocked down that barrier that Van Halen originally had built up, which was, of course, Quiet Riot with Metal Health at the time. A lot of times when you read these books and you know, watch these documentaries, they might give them a little blurb like, oh, yeah, Quiet Riot, Metal Health came out, number one record, woohoo, and then they move on. But you guys really did a great job of really focusing on how important that record and that band was, because I think over the years, I mean, Quiet Riot was more known as Randy Rhoads' first band, rather than being known as the band with the first number one selling metal album. And as you guys, you know, highlight, I mean, both them and Twisted Sister were both, you know, 70s bands that were on their last legs, and they were really the two that come out from the different coasts that really got this thing kicking off. So, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but do you guys, I mean, it seems to me you guys obviously made a point when putting the book together to really highlight and focus on other bands that were in the scene, obviously, rather than just, you know, Motley Crue, Poison, and Guns N' Roses, the ones that usually get all the attention. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And a lot of what you said is really right on the nose. I mean, going back to the Quiet Riot thing, and actually going back to the Van Halen thing quickly, I think that was one of the things that Tom and I really learned, you know, that we sort of learned about as we were doing this book. We had a sense of the fact that, yeah, in the early 80s, you had all these punk and new wave bands and the bands, as you put it, which is very true. But it wasn't until doing the book, I think, that we really got a real picture of how uncool this music was in that time between Van Halen and, you know, Crew and Quiet Riot and all that stuff, where the bands were really, you know, the labels wanted nothing to do with it. And I think Rudy Sarzo from Quiet Riot is the one that says, we were considered dinosaur music. Like, it was just completely outdated. And, you know, that led all of these bands to do the whole DIY thing and really figure it out for themselves. But yeah, you're right about Quiet Riot being the band that breaks it all open a few years later. And we really wanted to show, I mean, people know about Come On, Feel the Noise, although we do tell that story in pretty great detail in the book. And it's an interesting story how that all comes about. But this is a band that was there in the 70s and were Van Halen's peer. And then, you know, everything falls apart for them. But they persevere and they come back. And it was a way of showing, you know, I mean, you could make that case for a lot of these bands that were around since the 70s and went through a lot of tough times before coming out the other end. It was not this overnight sensation type of thing for a lot of these bands, especially that first wave of bands. And Quiet Riot, yeah, I mean, I think they don't necessarily get their due because they didn't really persevere for too long after. They flamed out pretty quick. You know, and so they didn't really reap the spoils of the later 80s, and which they actually helped to create, which is sort of a sad, you know, aspect of their career. But they were so important to this music taking off. And I don't know, you know, I don't know that a lot of these bands really would have happened had it not been for Quiet Riot and MTV and all of that. So yeah, we wanted to give them their due.
Yeah, sure. Now, were you guys LA guys at the time that this was going up, or were you so, like, I'm from the Midwest and I'm 52, so I was right in the pocket of the right age for it, but I was in the Midwest, so, you know, I didn't hear about Quiet Riot until they were blasted on MTV, where they obviously had, you know, 5, 6, 7 years on the scene first. So were you guys part of the LA scene, or did you guys develop your knowledge from interviews specifically and from reading or watching other people's, you know, interpretations?
I'm about to be 50 and I had the same experience as you, that, like, you know, I'm from New York. So I grew up in New York City, and Rich is from Long Island, but I had no sense when, you know, when I'm 12 or 13 or whatever, and Come On, Feel the Noise and We're Not Going to Take It comes on MTV. I had no sense at all. I mean, if I'd stopped to think about it, I could have looked at those guys and been like, man, maybe they don't look 20, you know, but like, I really had no sense of that. These were bands that had been around for a long time. I didn't know that Twisted Sister had already put out, you know, a couple records. I didn't know that Quiet Riot had put out a bunch of records. And that is, I think, again, why we really wanted to focus on this. I think later on in the decade, when people start writing off this genre of music as sort of being like this corporate rock phenomenon, they don't understand that these bands were originally bands that, like, nobody wanted to touch. So, like, I had no idea what was going on in LA. You know, later other bands came to me early, like White Lion, because there was a great radio station out here called WSOU, which was Seton Hall, mm-hmm. University Pirate Radio. So they were like a like later in the decade, they were the ones who were suddenly like playing Kicks, you know, early on, and you know, White Lion and other bands like that. So they were breaking the East Coast bands, you know, earlier to me, but like, I had no idea what was going on in LA, particularly like in the late, I don't think either of us really understood it until we started doing all these interviews that these guys were out there, and that, you know, I never thought of George Lynch as a contemporary of Eddie Van Halen.
Okay.
You know, but really they were, like, Eddie Van Halen, George Lynch, and Randy Rhoads were the three hot guitar players in LA in like 1977. Right. It's just that Eddie gets signed in 1977 and it takes another 5 years, you know, for George Lynch or, you know, 4 years for George Lynch to get signed in Dokken, but they were all 70s guys.
Right.
But it's hard to get that sense when you're somewhere else and you're not, you know, all we knew, like you're same as me. All we knew is what MTV showed us.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. Definitely. Well, you know, and the one thing that I'm curious about from reading, and I'll be point blank, the book's 1300 pages on my phone, so I'm nowhere near done. You
know, sorry about that.
No, by all means. Wow. You know what, it's better that than something that I don't want to read, so it's great. The thing is you tell such, through the use of the different interviews, you guys tell such unique stories about what these bands how they came up, what their unique stories were, what their development was. How much of that did you know going in versus how much did you actually learn just from talking to these guys and get that oh shit moment where you're like, wow, how did that happen?
Yeah, I think we definitely went in knowing a lot, knowing most of the time what we wanted to get out of these guys, and especially the book tells the story of the scene, but as you've also seen it there's like six or seven bands that we also really focus in on and tell their entire story. And for those bands, we went a little deeper and had a good sense of what that story was that we wanted to tell. But then within doing those interviews and getting that sort of full picture, other stories pop up and it could just be because somebody just kind of mentioned something offhand. And maybe it was something that somebody else mentioned and you're like, there's something there. Or maybe it's just something that it's just completely bizarre and you're like, we're going to find who else was there at that time and we're going to go down that path and really tell this story in much greater detail. And a lot of times it's something, that we had never heard before. One story, I won't go too deeply into it, but there's a story about Dokken recording the Tooth and Nail record, which is just this insane story about all these studio hijinks that are happening. And it's just like, it's a funny story, but it's also very, it gives insight into sort of the dysfunction at the heart of that band. And it was something that just came because Tom had interviewed Tom Werman, the producer, and he sort of just mentioned it offhand. And then from there, it's like, well, then we're going to talk to Don Dokken about it. We're going to talk to George Lynch about it. We're going to talk to Wild Mick Brown about it. And you get this full picture and they all remembered it, but it's not something they would have brought up without being asked about it. I mean, I remember Don Dokken in particular. It was certainly something that it seemed like he hadn't thought about, in over 30 years. But because somebody else mentioned it, then you can talk to him about it. And we put together this picture of like this just crazy recording studio event that winds up being a whole chapter in the book.
Yeah, yeah, there are a lot of weird, like even in the Cinderella story, I was, and it's often an outsider who sort of brings it up, not somebody in the band. Like the photographer Ross Halfen mentioned that Cinderella basically destroyed their career because they pulled out of a European tour in 1991 because the Gulf War was starting and they got spooked.
Okay.
And they were in England, and they were like, we're not going to Europe. And you hear a story like that and you're like, huh. And they're interviewing the manager and he's like, oh yeah, totally. That's how we blew it. We blew it in Europe. We had Europe in our, and then you start talking to the people in the band and these different points of view, like I wanted to stay. I wanted to go, we went from the, and you get suddenly end up with this really compelling story that is not one, like that's something like I did not go in. I was pretty well researched doing my Cinderella interviews. And like, that was not something that was at all on my radar. And it's great when you find stuff like that, because then I get to call Rich and be like, dude, check this out.
Yeah, exactly.
did you find at all that the story, anybody's stories didn't match what everybody else was saying? Like just completely didn't match, or was everybody sort of on point when you brought up specific issues?
What do you think, Rich?
For the most part, I didn't really find that. I think that, and I've said this before, I think that, sometimes it was like people had a different opinion about maybe the way something went down and maybe like whose fault it was, let's say, or something like that. But nobody told a story that was like wildly different in terms of remembering like the facts or like, or something like that. Like I would say, I mentioned this Nirvana book I did a few years ago that was an oral history as well. And like just, by comparison, two of the people in that were Courtney Love and like Kurt Cobain's mother. Pretty much everything one of them said, the other said the exact opposite. And like believed, had a just completely different narrative about life. But in this book, I think that was one of the cool things about it. Like you would talk to somebody and get a story and then you'd talk to someone else about it. And like, actually they were like, oh yeah. And it was pretty close, I felt like. So you could trust everybody's memory in a way.
There's one instance of somebody throwing somebody through a plate glass window and the other person denying it in our book. Then I'll let you discover who that is. But like, that's probably the one time where one person says like, this happened, and the other person's like, nah, that didn't happen.
Yeah. Although the other person did say that they did say that it happened.
Right. That's true.
So that it was, but they just made it up at the time. So, but the other person did believe that it did happen, but it's also later in the book. So you're probably not there yet.
Well, you know, I could definitely tell you guys are definitely East Coast guys, because I'll tell you one thing you definitely did is did a bang up job of really showing the, you know, the differences between the LA scene and then the East Coast scene, because, you know, a lot of times you don't hear too much about what went on the East Coast, because, well, it wasn't probably as interesting, right? I mean, Sunset Strip, you had, I mean, for one thing, it seemed like to me from the interviews, I mean, it was pretty obvious, was that one of the secrets to success was becoming a house band at one of those venues. I mean, Van Halen and Striper, you know, which was Rock's regime at the time, were Kazari's, Quiet Riot, the Starwood, Poison at the Troubadour, Motley Crue and Rat at the Whiskey. I mean, that seemed, because those bands could all bring in the girls, and that's why they became the house bands. But I mean, it seemed like they think that the difference between, I think, the East Coast and LA was, for one, on in the LA Sunset Strip scene, I mean, you could break without even having to go out and tour. All you had to do was be one of the biggest draws at the venues there, and boom, I mean, the record companies are right there. They'd notice and then sign you. Where on the East Coast, and I grew up just like you guys, I grew up in New York as well. I mean, it was so different because there wasn't necessarily a scene, so to speak. I mean, it went from what, Philadelphia to Maryland, from Kix to obviously Britney Fox and Cinderella in Philadelphia and everything in between. Obviously, all the bands in New York and New Jersey between that. But it was such a different, you know, I guess it didn't have a specific scene. You had to play those circuits in order to get, you know, I guess, noticed or discovered, where LA, you just had to go in that 3 mile, you know, radius there. And so, I mean, obviously that's one of the things, like I said, you guys, I think, did really well, was showcase, you know, the differences between the, you know, the different codes. And not only that, you really focused on a lot of bands in New York. I mean, you did such, you know, I mean, between Cinderella and Winger, you did all these real in-depth, I think, looks at those bands, which a lot of times people don't, I've never read any book or anything or seen any documentary where they've gone in that detail with those bands. So I think you guys, that's a one point, you know, part of the book that I just think was phenomenal, that you guys obviously concentrated on pretty heavily, if correct here.
Yeah, and it's hard to pull together an East Coast, you know, we got sort of, it was funny, we got sort of towards the end of the book and we realized, you know, Rich did a lot of the West Coast stuff, and it is true, it's a much more exciting thing, because it's, you've got all this crazy colorful stuff happening in this very, very localized area, whereas with New York, the bands are spread out. They're not, none of the bands in the New York, I mean, maybe Kix was, could draw really well, but a lot of them are doing covers and stuff. There's not like this one little area, and so they're all spread out, and a lot of the bands actually in New York, it's funny, get signed without playing any shows. You know, it's like, I mean, or they play a lot of shows and they're driving around and going to, you know, but they're not, none of them can draw like the LA bands could. Like, I don't think Skid Row could ever pull 1,500 people to a show, or White Line could pull 1,500 people before they were signed. But we really wanted to tell that side of the story as well, because a lot of great bands did come out of this area. It's just that it wasn't as sort of tight-knit a scene, even L'Amour, which seems to be like the center of it all in Brooklyn, you know, is a place that also caters heavily to thrash and all kinds of different, you know, metal styles. So it's not like this one spot where all the bands come out of. But it was really interesting, you know, talking to the you know, the New York bands, I think they all feel that, and the East Coast bands feel they're all a little bit tougher because they've had to deal with the winters and they didn't, you know, have like the strip and stuff like that. So I think that they feel that they're a little bit grittier, and they probably are on a lot of levels.
And I would just add to that, I mean, Tom handled a lot of the East Coast stuff, and to me that was actually a real feat, because I'm someone that grew up in New York and I couldn't even really wrap my head around the scene. Right. Like, it's just, it's so just kind of amorphous that even being someone that's spent my entire life listening to this music and living in that place, like, it just, it didn't even make sense to how to sort of put all that together in a way where you're really telling a story of what was going on at that time, and you can put the reader there. But I think the book does that.
You know, we really, that's why I went after, like, the guys in Spread Eagle and the guys, you know, mm-hmm. in Law and Order and stuff, like, bands who didn't end up being huge because they were a little bit later, but, you know, that you need to sort of give a picture of what's happening in New York a little bit with the Limelight and the Cat Club and stuff. And again, mm-hmm. in terms of the scope of that, it's not, it just can't compete mm-hmm. with mm-hmm. the Strip.
Sure.
You know, like, yeah. that was ground zero. So, but you mm-hmm. still have to, there's still a lot of, you know, between the Skids and Kicks and White Lion, that enough came out of here that there was something happening here too.
Sure. Well, it seemed to me that towards the end, like you just mentioned, Spread Eagle is one of the bands. It was almost like a lot of the East, because to me, I just noticed there was a lot more of the East Coast bands getting signed towards the end of it, around, you know, anywhere from 89 to about 91. I mean, Danger, Trickster. You said Spread Eagle, Steelheart. I mean, even the female band, Soraya and Fiona. I mean, there was a whole bunch that was coming out at sort of like the last, I think, push. That obviously it didn't, you know, because of the rise of grunge. Obviously, they didn't really take off. But it seems like they sort of were trying to maybe make something more out of it in, you know, between New York and New Jersey and the East Coast than it was early on, when it was pretty much, you know, mostly, except for the, you know, the, a couple of, you know, a few of Twisted Sister, whatever, it was mostly all LA.
Definitely. And also there's this thing, you know, which we talk about with the Twisted Sister thing, is that, like, you know, there was a thriving, the East Coast was about covers, you know, these bands, like, yeah. Twisted Sister, Dee Snider says that they were making, you know, each guy in that band, like, adjusted for inflation, was making a couple $100,000 a year playing covers. Mm-hmm. And so were the guys in Zebra and stuff. So there was a really thriving rock club culture on the East Coast. It just wasn't, mm-hmm. it wasn't focused on original music, unlike LA. You know, mm-hmm. New York City was, but there was not really rock and roll happening in New York City. There was punk and new wave and stuff mm-hmm. like that. So yeah. it's a weird thing. And I don't know why the bands towards the end, I mean, if you know, a lot of, I think at the end, just a lot more bands were getting signed because they were just mm-hmm. grabbing everything. So you true, still true. Get, like, you know, if you, Rich talked a lot with Stevie Rochelle from Tuff, and he's on the late end, you know, in LA too. So there was, mm-hmm. they were just grabbing anything they could, I think, at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely were. Now, you know, obviously the book is focused, not focused, but the bulk of what you're, the bands that you cover are the big ones, you know, the big bands of the era. But it seems as time has gone on, the bands that weren't as big, the Junkyards, Badlands, Blue Murder, Love Hate, Vane, etc., the bands that didn't have the huge breakout have become, I don't want to say more popular than the Rats and Motley Crue or whatever, but they've risen where they didn't rise at the time. Why do you think that is?
I think, I think that some of these bands, it's like a rediscovery, you know, it's like, because people, this music, as it's come back into style, for lack of a better way to put it, I mean, yeah, you have the people that listened to it at the time, still into it, or maybe getting back into it. But then you obviously have this new generation of kids. You know, and at some point they know their Motley Crue, and they know their Rat, and they know their Guns N' Roses, and then it's all of a sudden now they're, you know, through Spotify or whatever, now, like, you start going down that rabbit hole, and then you start finding out about Tuff and Bang Tango and, you know, Pretty Boy Floyd and all these bands that we cover as well. And it's like, you know, that's all of a sudden, that's like new music to you. You're hearing it for the first time, so it's fresh, and it's like they're discovering it the same way we discovered it in 1988 when we heard it for the first time. So yeah, it was important to cover a lot of these bands, because partly because, you know, there's books out there on Motley Crue, and there's your Guns N' Roses books and all that stuff. A lot of that stuff has been told. So we still told it, but we would approach it from a different direction. You know, the Guns N' Roses stuff in particular, we really went deep on the formative years and the Hollywood Rose years and the LA Guns sort of crossover, and tried to tell that in a way that I don't think it's really been told before, with a lot of those voices, those guys who were in the band in the early days, talking about how it all happened. But then these other bands, you know, you want to give that experience to the reader as well, of what it was like being on the Strip but not being Poison, and but still being kind of a superstar, but not, you know, but you're sort of a superstar in your town, and maybe not playing arenas all over the country, but it gives such a different perspective on what the hustle was like and what these bands were going through, you know, even in the later part of the 80s. So it was a really important thing to tell in the book.
Definitely. Now, I do not want to turn this into a political conversation at all, but I do have a sort of political question, I guess. Do you think, given today's social climate, do you think that it diminishes how people look at the 80s, or do you actually think it emboldens it because we were lucky enough to be a part of it when decadence wasn't necessarily bad or ugly or whatever term you want to use?
I think that there are certain, we were very careful. Look, like we say in the introduction to the book that like our goal was not to go around and make people apologize,
sure,
for what they did. And I think, you know, there's definitely stuff from that era that is, I don't even know if regrettable is even the word, but of a different era, like the, you know, the way the videos were, you know, the way women were represented or in the videos and then not really represented that much in the bands. And I think it's part of also what made this music sort of like vulnerable when it did get taken out. At the same time, it's all part and parcel with this, you know, like you can't, like those videos, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that as a 14 or 15 year old, I did not find those videos to be awesome, and that wasn't part of sort of the attraction of it to me. You know, and that like I thought, you know, I like totally had a crush on whoever the actress is who's in Poison's Fallen Angel video. Sure. Whoever you were, I don't know, and I have an IMDb, but you know, like, so there, I think that, like, can it happen again that way? No. But is it part of what sort of made that era? It's part of what made that music and that era fun. And looking back on the videos, you can sort of see that there were issues with it. But, you know, the fact that you were watching these bands as a young person, like my age or, and seeing, you know, part of it was a fiction being created maybe by the videos and like what you're seeing, but you're seeing this thing going on in LA and in these videos, and you're like, they are living the ultimate life. Like they're partying and they're being paid attention to by women, and they shred on their guitars, and like they're basically superheroes, you know, like, and I think I consider myself lucky to have sort of gotten into music at a time where the musicians were superheroes. Like I was totally, my imagination was totally captivated by it. That doesn't mean that I'm going to sit here and tell you that, you know, that there were videos and album covers that weren't sexist, but I can tell you that at the time, and also, you know, a lot of the people in the book have evolved at this point. You know what I mean? Like they're 50, 60 now. They're not who they were when they were 21 and on the Strip.
Right. Yeah. Agree. And you know, the interesting thing is I honestly think that even though there is a resurgence of that musical style going on right now, whether it's bands like Crazy Licks or Crash Diet, or, you know, there's a litany of those bands that are out there right now. I think that that's the reason that style is not making a bigger comeback than it is, because people that lived it are not going to accept it without the full decadent piece of it. And people that are younger are never going to allow that decadent thing to be. So it's almost, it's almost at cross purposes within itself to where it can't make a comeback. Do you agree?
I think it could be. Yeah. I think that's probably part of it. I mean, I think, another part of it would just be that I don't know that the best way to have this type of music live on is to do it in exactly the same way. And that's not to say that I think any of these bands are just completely ripping off what happened back then, but you see a lot of bands now that are very 80s influenced that, you know, that nail the sound and the look and the hair and everything like down to a T, and they're trying to recreate it, which has its place. Certainly it has its place if you want to go see a band in a club, because you're not going to experience, you know, Rat as 20-year-olds in a small club anymore, or Motley Crue. Like, you can't get that again. So you can get that from a new band, but I don't know if that's a recipe for longevity and, you know, a real sort of creative, you know, focused career. So I think the bands that incorporate elements of the 80s into what they do, you know, but don't just try to ape it in every way, are the ones that have more success in building their own careers.
The other thing is, as people are age, it's why things can't happen again, is there isn't MTV anymore. Like, we were all having a common experience of this music. Like, I would guess that you, like, everybody here at midnight on, what was it, on Saturday night, was watching Headbangers Ball. You're all watching Headbangers Ball. So, like, if there was a new Lillian Axe video, if there's a new Spread Eagle video, if there's, you know, we all saw it. And we weren't like, oh, maybe I'll explore this on YouTube. There was a limited delivery mechanism. So we were all seeing all these bands together. And it's and the bands that came out and succeeded became incredibly famous. You know, like, it's, there's this point in our book, and it's maybe not the best example, you might not be a fan of the band, but like, where the guys Gunnar and Matthew Nelson talk about, like, they get to the point where, like, if they go to a mall, there's going to be a riot. You know, like, these bands were as famous gets. And so, you know, it's maybe 40 bands from that era, but we all know them. And now everybody's fighting for that. You know, there's no Headbangers Ball. There's no, you know, Dial MTV, where we were all seeing the same thing at once, so that 35 years later, I can talk to you and say Lillian Axe, and you're like, oh yeah, Lillian Axe.
Yeah. No, I mean, you're right. The market's so saturated too. And like you said, there's so many, you know, delivery mechanisms you can get music from, whether you watch it or listen to it. Where, like you said, all we were doing back then was really living vicariously through MTV, wishing we were out in LA on the Sunset Strip. And like you said, it's because of, there's only that, you know, that one delivery, you know, these days. Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I don't think necessarily that the sort of culture or, you know, scene or whatever. Yeah, I don't think that can be duplicated. However, I do think there is, I mean, there's some really good bands out there. Maybe not doing anything original, but they're sort of, you know, we interviewed a great band the other day called the LA Maybe. They're out of North Carolina. And I mean, a great band. The singer, he was one of the four that tried out for AC/DC when Brian Johnson was out in 2016. And I mean, they have the right attitude. They've got the right, you know, the music is there. Everything's there. But yeah, in terms of, I think, everything else, I agree. I don't think it could ever be duplicated. But in the meantime, and, you know, the one thing I just want to, you know, close with here is that, you know, with your guys' book, it's a real fun book, you know. And I think that was, I think, one of the main things you guys really wanted to hone in on was the celebratory and funness of this music, where seemingly afterwards, when grunge did sort of come in, you haven't really seen, at least in my opinion, rock music. I just haven't seen or heard anything that's been fun like that again. You know, I mean, everything kind of got a little more serious and angrier. And, you know, hopefully we can get something in that realm, but you know, to be to take off with maybe some of the younger generation of music fans and musicians. But you guys did a really great job at displaying, you know, just what a fun time that was, a fun decade and just a fun period where music was fun. And you know, hopefully we can at least get that, you know, some come back around sometime in the future. But anyway, guys, so the book is Nothing But a Good Time, The Uncensored History of the 80s Hard Rock Explosion. Once again, it comes out March 16th. And why don't you guys tell the listeners where they can go ahead and check out the book and buy it?
Yeah, I mean, you can basically go to any of your favorite online retailers, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any of the more sort of local indie bookstores. It's up on all those. I mean, if you go to our publisher's page, which is Macmillan, it also lists a bunch of different, it has a bunch of different links for different places where you can purchase the book.
But yeah, your favorite bookstore can order it now, and hopefully we'll have it when it comes out, you know? And any and all pre-orders are appreciated, because everything that gets ordered before the week that we come out gets counted towards the first week sales. So that's super important for us. So like, if you think you might want this book, buy it
right now,
sooner than later. Damn it. But sure. You know, but yeah, so it's available everywhere. There's also an audio book that's coming out at the same time. So if you prefer audiobooks, that is also available to you.
Awesome. Well, you just sold one, because I will buy the audiobook.
Awesome. So there we go. So that's coming out exactly at the same time.
Awesome. Great, man. Well, yeah, once again, Nothing But a Good Time, The Uncensored History of the 80s Hard Rock Explosion, comes out March 16th. And Tom and Rich, thank you guys so much for coming on here and talking with us about this awesome book you guys coming out.
Thank you so much for having us. It was a pleasure. And no, seriously, we're grateful for people paying attention to this thing. So thank you.
Thanks for listening to Aftershocks. For more episodes, go to our website at www.aftershockspodcast.com. Visit us on our Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter pages for more news and information on the podcast. And be sure to subscribe, listen to, and review all episodes on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and all other podcast platforms. For your music listening pleasure, visit our website or go to www.shockwavesradio.com. For all comments and questions, please email us at info@aftershockspodcast.com.
All right, everybody, another great interview right here on Aftershocks TV. And before we go, just want to remind you one more time, make sure you get over and subscribe to the CMS Podcast Network, cmspn.com. You can watch, you can listen, you can subscribe to everything that we do, not only us, but the Classic Metal Show, Shockwave Skull Sessions, Talk To Me. It's all there, one site, get four great shows, never have to do anything again but be entertained. So check it out, cmspn.com, cmspn.com, cmspn.com. Until next time, folks.